some hard traveling. I thought you knowed. I've been having some hard traveling way down the road.
That's Hard Traveling by the great workers' bard Woody Guthrie. Born on this day in 1912. I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We're about to look at women in sports in some very unique ways, both in terms of what happened in the World Cup and the controversies around that, and Dave Zirin, who one of our guests, one of his great articles in The Nation about that, and Kavitha Davidson joins us, a Bloomberg View sports columnist. We're also going to touch on Serena Williams and more. Dave Zirin, of course, is also host of Edge on Sports Radio, sports editor for The Nation, author of numerous books, including Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. Dave and Kavitha, welcome. Good to have you both back.
Thank you.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Always good to have you all. 410-319-8888 is the number. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888, or you can get on our Facebook pages. I'll jump in there and take a look, 410-319-8888. I don't know where to begin. Let's begin with the latest news and work our way backwards here, because they're all connected to me. When Serena Williams won, the New York Times, and what was quoted in the New York Times about her body, about her being masculine, about the femininity of players, it was pretty mind-boggling. I mean, not that I didn't expect some kind of deeply misogynist and racist things to happen, but I guess, Dave Zirin, I wasn't expected for the depth of it.
No, I mean, I'd be honest with you, I certainly expected it, because it hasn't stopped from the moment Serena Williams really became the supreme Williams sister, basically, and exceeded her own sister, Venus, and instead of being Venus's little sister, became not only the best Williams sister, but also, as John McEnroe said, perhaps the best female athlete of the last 100 years. And so since Serena started showing that that was her potential, and since, you know, she just started being the Serena Williams we all know, and just to be clear, like, I think that Serena is the Muhammad Ali of our time, and I will defend that, and if anybody wants to argue it with me, I will defend that factually. She's our Muhammad Ali, and in every way, shape, and form. And I think that just like Muhammad Ali, people, journalists made it their mission to tear Ali down, and people have always there have always been a sector of people who've made it their mission to tear Serena Williams down. Except she deals with intersectional oppressions of sexism and the particular sexism faced by black women that not even Muhammad Ali had to face. So, no, I wasn't surprised at how ugly the coverage was. I was only more disappointed that it was just yet another example that we haven't gotten past that point.
And Kavitha, I mean, one of the things that struck me about the thing with Serena that we've talked about here is that one part of the things we're dealing with here is this whole kind of racist construction of what beauty means, of image, of femininity, of power, and it's kind of fueling all of this.
Well, absolutely, and it's also a way to kind of delegitimize her as an athlete, because we're talking about her body as if these are natural physical gifts and not her work ethic and not, you know, her on-court IQ and not, you know, the way that she's grown and evolved her game and changed the game of tennis in itself. We're talking about her body instead of those things. And that's a very racially wrapped up thing. We do that to black male athletes all the time. But as you said, and as Dave said, this is very intersectional. This is what we do to delegitimize women's sports in many ways as well.
I mean, because one of the things that when I was reading the pieces here just about her, the way certain sports commentators described her muscular body as being like natural and not something that she worked on to become strong and powerful, and then other tennis players talking about they wanted to remain small and petite and feminine. I kept thinking about what we do to our own consciousness about women in this society, what is done to women's consciousness in the society, and how it is how it also leads in some ways to something you were writing about, Dave, the diminution in the popular media of women in sports.
Absolutely. I mean, it's all deeply, deeply connected. And the irony about the body obsession with Serena, is that you can also chart how it's changed over the course of time. I mean, people have been really hypercritical of her body. I mean, can you imagine somebody saying that Tom Brady has a chest like a chicken?
Right,
or that,
right.
Or that, you know, like, or that Peyton Manning really, you know, looks like he wears a particularly small athletic cup. And what does that say about his leadership? That he might not need a regular man-sized cup. First of all, I've never seen Peyton Manning naked. I'm not saying anything about his equipment or that thereof. I'm just saying that what I mean that to me would be kind of the equivalent, except it's actually even worse than that. Because if, say, someone did write an article about Tom Brady's lack of musculature or Peyton Manning's absence of adult genitalia, I mean, nobody, I mean, it would be embarrassing and awful for Peyton Manning, but it wouldn't have a ripple effect on all men. You see, when Serena is attacked for it used to be fat and out of shape, now she's too muscular, even though she basically looks the same, when she's attacked, it really is about attacking women's sports. It's about attacking black women and their bodies in a place like tennis, which has been so traditionally white, so traditionally European, and so traditionally, there's no other word for it, but almost police-like in the way that they police the shape and manner of women in the sport. So it's such a incredible world. This is why I like the Ali, when I say like Ali and even beyond Muhammad Ali, it's that with Muhammad Ali, people said, just shut up and box, meaning that they still wanted him to box. They just wanted him to shut up.
Right.
Box. And even Ali, you go back and look at it, even Ali's worst detractors said, you know what? This guy is built like a Greek god. I mean, what a body, what a look, how handsome. If only he wouldn't talk about this Nation of Islam and Vietnam War stuff, then he'd be awesome. But with Serena, it's much more like, gosh, it would be just so nice if you weren't here. Because the same way, you know, people looked at Rodney Dangerfield when he walked into the club at Caddyshack. You know, it's this idea that you don't belong in this space. And that obviously has a harmful ripple effect beyond the Williams family, but to everybody who's been made to feel like they don't belong.
And so I think the harmful effect is there, Kavitha. And I think about the other side of this, the potential other side of this, is what this explosively could change for black women, for sports, for the American conception of what a man and woman means and beauty and more. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I think that when these things happen, especially in this era where we are in an era of kind of confronting the racism in terms of police and more and blatant stuff that people have kind of ignored for too long, this may be opening another door.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, going back to what you were saying about other female players saying that they didn't want to, you know, grow their bodies in the same way that that Serena has. They wanted to maintain whatever, you know,
yeah,
their conceptions of femininity are. You know, the sad part about that commentary is that it works, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, you look at Serena versus Maria Sharapova and how dominant Serena has been in the game and successful. And she serves 120 miles an hour. And, you know, a lot of that is because of, you know, how she's worked at her body and everything. Maria Sharapova is still, you know, far and away outpacing her in endorsement deals. And you have people saying, well, that's because, you know, you're just giving the public what they want and totally ignoring this role that the media plays in shaping our popular tastes and the way that we look at femininity and the way that we look at what we consider to be marketable. We really need to take more responsibility for what we're putting out to the public and for what we are valuing in female athletes.
So
If I hear, I'm so grateful for Kavitha's commentary on this issue, like the canon of Kavitha's work, because if I hear one more person say we're just giving the public what they want as
right,
a justification for disrespecting female athletes, for not covering female athletes, you know, I'm gonna knock somebody out. It's the equivalent of the way, like, McDonald's will say, hey, we're just giving the people what they want by having Coca-Cola products. And it's just like, no, that's you actually have a financial interest in pushing Coca-Cola. That's not giving the public what they want. If the public started going into McDonald's and begging for healthy kale smoothies, they wouldn't get them because it's not the way that McDonald's has built its particular economic empire upon. And I'll just say what I mean by that is that basically ESPN, the big sports networks, not just ESPN at all, but all the big networks have decided to put billions of dollars, billions, for the broadcast rights of the National Football League and the NBA, most particularly. And there is then a financial interest in skewing the journalism to covering these very sports. And so it's one feeds the other, because you're trying to feed this idea that people need to watch the things that you've just paid billions of dollars to show. You know, so that's producing a need. That's producing a desire when in reality, I don't think it truly reflects the audience out there. And proof of that, I think proof positive is, you know, the World Cup ratings, which were absolutely stratospheric. But that's just, to me, the latest example of the ways in which tastes are created by a media that has a financial interest in having women's sports in a very back-of-the-bus secondary role.
So on both those things, let me start with the last thing you just said, Dave, and go back to something that Kavitha said about Serena and endorsements. But the when you do look at the World Cup ratings, I mean, and people were just, the world was off the hook with the Women's World Cup. People I know all over here who people don't even love soccer were watching the games. You know, and I normally don't, I played soccer for years, but I don't usually watch as much as I did this time. But the question is, how does that power dynamic begin to change? I mean, because clearly there is a conscious movement on the part of corporate America to make women's sports secondary, tertiary, to the public, to the public's ability to access it, to the seriousness in which we take it.
Just real quick, I'm curious what Kavitha thinks about this, but I'll just say real quick, when we talk about corporate America, I think that there is a push to make women's spectator sports secondary, tertiary.
Right.
When it comes to women as athletic consumers, they're all in, which to me only adds to the disrespect. It's saying that, like, you know, you can, we want your money for the latest Lycra this or the latest shoe that, the latest cross trainer this or that, but what they don't want is to be part of the mechanism that creates star athletes and creates spectatorship. And spectatorship is a huge part of how sports are understood and consumed in the United States. We're a nation of watchers as much or more than we're a nation of doers in this regard. And we could have a whole separate critical discussion about that and how problematic that is. But as long as spectatorship is such a big part of sports, the message that it sends I think hasn't shifted a great deal in the last decades. And if anything, if you look at some of the recent studies about the ways in which women's highlights are shown and portrayed, in many ways, it's actually worse now than it was 30 years ago, which is absolutely striking. Certainly, when I was growing up and I would get my Sports Illustrated every Thursday in the mail and rush to pick it up, it was far more likely, and statistically this bears out, it was far more likely 30 years ago to have a woman athlete on the cover than it is today. So it's not the case that there may be some bumps in the road, but there's slow, steady progress. In a lot of ways, there's been a great deal of regress over the last three decades.
I think Dave is spot on. To point to the disconnect between targeting women as consumers and not targeting women as athletes. I guess in that sense, it is kind of progress, because for so long, female fans were just ignored. And I think especially with women's issues, we're at a we'll take what we can get kind of phase. But on the one hand, you have advertisers and you have league officials and executives now targeting women and our dollars and our eyeballs and our viewership and everything. But you're also having these same executives and defenders of these sports shows saying that, you know, if you want women's sports to be covered more, then why aren't female fans watching them more? And they're putting the onus for that on women themselves and not on us as a sports fan nation and as a whole. And that's really where that disconnect comes in. The idea that somehow a male fan isn't going to want to watch women's soccer is absolutely preposterous. But if you market it that way, and if that's the message that you're sending to the public, then the public will start to buy into that. Whereas if you show people that really, you know, women's soccer in this country is the far superior product that you're putting on the field, then soccer fans of both genders will want to watch it, regardless of the gender of the people on the field itself.
So, you know, and coming back from, let me go to the phones here. We do have some calls coming in. 410-319-8888 is the number as we sit here talking with Kavitha Davidson and Dave Zirin about women and sports. And the big pieces of news, of course, is both the racist, sexist kind of explosion around Serena Williams' victory and who she is as a woman, as a black woman, and the lack of kind of seriousness that so many in the sports industry take women in sports. 410-319-8888. Ray, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank God. I wanted to offer a book. Mark, you may be familiar with it from about I don't know, back in the day, 15 years ago. It was called Darwin's Athlete.
Darwin's Athlete, is that what you said?
Darwin. Uh-huh. Darwin's Athlete. Uh-huh. Written by a guy by the name of John Hoberman. Your guests would love this book because it explores from a historical point of view from the time African Americans arrived here, how their bodies were always considered animalistic. It touched on everything from sports to the Tuskegee experiment and many other experiments like Tuskegee that never made it. But it touched on how we have these superhuman powers, and I think your female guest pointed out a really good point about they don't talk about Serena's IQ, her work ethic, her staying in shape. You know, she's too big, she's too little. But, you know, when you reduce this to the lowest common denominator, you're talking about people who happen to be African American who in 2015 are not considered human. And this permeates to all aspects of society. Look at what happens when police, you know, shoot African Americans. They all say the same thing. He looked like, he turned into a superhuman. His eyes became big, his muscles, you know, I was afraid for my life. It looked like he was just going to tear me apart. So, part of this, I don't want to talk about this now, but I wonder if some of this is almost genetic, built into us, this fear of a darker people. And, Darwin's Athlete is a book that I know that both of your guests would love based on the narrative.
Yeah, I don't know. I've just looked it up, so I'm going to order it and take a look at it. I've not read that book. So, Kavitha, you want to jump in and grab Ray's thought first?
Yeah, if you look at scout, and this is true for men and women, if you look at scouting reports, for example, for black NFL players versus white NFL players, the language is very starkly different. You see with black players, it's always, natural ability and fast and strong and all of these things that kind of speak to a genetic physical superiority. And with white athletes, it's always leadership and work ethic and,
right,
and on the field intelligence and things like that. And for so many years, that was actually used, as a reason that black athletes were funneled into running back and wide receiver positions and kind of kept away from, the leadership of the quarterback position. So that is definitely something that black athletes, both male and female, face. The difference with what Serena is facing is that when a black male athlete faces that, for the most part, it happens on an individual level and suppresses entire groups of male athletes, but it's not used to delegitimize the very concept of having black male athletes, of having black players in the NFL whatsoever. With Serena, it's almost, she doesn't belong here. This brand of tennis that she plays isn't what this game is supposed to be for women. In some way, her kind of women's tennis is illegitimate. And that is really what's damaging here, is that it's used as a commentary on the overall value and worth of not only her as an athlete, but her game and the women's game as compared to the men's.
Dave, you want to leap in on that as well? At all?
Yeah, no, I mean, I disagree. I mean, I agree strongly with everything that Kavitha just said. If anything, though, I've read, I want to actually go back to something with the caller. Like, I've read Darwin's Athlete.
Oh, uh-huh.
I've read a lot by John Hoberman, and while I certainly would not discourage anyone to read it, because there's a lot to learn from the history that he goes through in terms of the relationship between sports and black America, I also think the book is incredibly wooden and mechanical because it only sees it from one perspective, and that's the ways in which sports has this damaging effect on black America. And without question, there's enough damage there that you can write a whole book, but it also ignores the way people like Serena Williams can also be very empowering representations, can be really the sports version of Bree Newsom climbing up and taking down the Confederate flag, can be like a representation politically of a sense of pride and power that pushes people to confront racism and sexism and the intersectionality of the oppressions faced by black women and have discussions like the ones that we're having that we wouldn't otherwise have. And on top of that, with someone like Serena Williams, this is why I make the Ali comparison, she hasn't been content to merely be a representational political figure. She's also used her platform to speak out about issues like the criminal justice system,
right. The
Confederate flag, like pay equity for female athletes. And so these things are positive. So Hoberman's view of black athletes is almost like that they're these almost like wind-up toys on the field, and we marvel at their physicality. And what that does is it diminutizes the importance of developing the mind. And, of course, there is a truth in that, but that's not the full truth, because many of these black athletes have taken that hyper-exalted brought-to-you-by-Nike platform and really used it to say something about the world. I mean, Mark, you and I had long discussions about the great things that Adam Jones in Baltimore was doing and speaking about the uprising and using the platform to do so, of Buck Showalter basically showing David Simon how to actually speak about what white people should or should not say with regards to what was happening in Baltimore. And those are powerful statements. And to me, that cuts against what John Hoberman's big narrative is in that book.
Interesting. Yeah, I've not read the book, so I don't know the work at all. But it was interesting to hear your analysis of that. And I'm thinking about, let me go back for a tennis moment. I was thinking about this because the other day was the anniversary of Althea Gibson winning Wimbledon, being the first black woman to win that tournament in the 54, if I have it right. I'm thinking about her victory in the middle of the kind of the starkest racist time in our lifetime, in the 40s and 50s of this country. And then thinking about where tennis has gone with Martina Navratilova and what happened to her, and her ostracization and her losing a lot in that as well, and where we've come to with Serena. There's an arc here, Kavitha. Can you tie that together?
Yeah, well, there's absolutely an arc. I mean, with Martina, you know, her sexual orientation and you know, her physical appearance was also used to say that, you know, she was somehow not on the same playing field as her competition, and it was, you know, and you know, she somehow had a leg up, or maybe she had, you know, male hormones, or, you know, some kind of ridiculous thing like that. And now we're seeing exactly the same thing happening with Serena, and basically both of these women, both of these extremely overachieving women, are having their own success used against them. The fact that, you know, Serena is so dominant on the court, well, there must be something going on there. You had, you know, David Frum tweeted a couple of days ago that her quote-unquote body issues about which the New York Times was writing were due to steroids. And you've never had any kind of real, you know, steroid accusation against Serena. And so you have this narrative that, you know, in order to be this good and in order to be this strong, there has to be something going on there, because you don't look like what we think a tennis player should look like. And that is something that tennis has been dealing with for decades now, and it comes from, you know, the roots of tennis, and it's in, you know, inspired by the nobility and its royal associations and everything like that. But that is something that I think that we need to finally get over, especially as American sports fans. We've never really put up with those kinds of pretensions before, so it's really odd to me that we put up with them in tennis.
So, you know, and I wonder, maybe again going back to where what might be happening here as one of the outcomes of this, and when we're what we could be seeing for the future in terms of this could be one of those moments that begins a turn, a turn around how women perceive themselves and how men perceive women and society perceives women in terms of body and strength and athleticism and what femininity means and doesn't mean, but kind of changing. This could lead to a change. Because we're throwing it out there, because there's been so much pushback about what happened to Serena, there's so much anger among younger women, especially, and other people who care about not having the equality that they deserve in terms of the Women's World Cup team. I mean, I can see this could be one of those moments, Dave, that begins to shift things.
I mean, it could be. But I think what we...
You're not being as optimistic as me, eh?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not... It's more because, you know, looking at a century plus of women's sports, what you always see is that women's sports are only taken seriously, and they have been at different points in the last 100 years, but they're really only taken seriously when it's a social question. Like, the individual greatness of one individual athlete has just never been enough to raise the entire edifice that is women's sports. I mean, it's just, I just, that's not the way it's worked. It's worked because there's been a broader movement that's not been about women's athletics, but it's been about, frankly, fighting for gender equity, fighting for women's equality, fighting for gender justice. And when you have these broader demands in society, women's sports tends to be taken a lot more seriously as part as a cultural ricochet effect of that. And so when I think, like, is this going to be a turning point, I'm not only looking at Serena's awesomeness, which is or the U.S. World Cup ratings, which are absolutely pivotal cogs in this, and you can't have one really without the other, but I'm also looking at issues that have to do with gender justice, frankly, and with those narratives. And you really, you know, black women's lives matter and things like that. Like, it's very difficult to conceive of the elevation of one without the elevation of the other.
Kavitha?
I agree with that, and I think that it's at least encouraging that you're seeing both of these discussions occurring simultaneously. You're having the Black Women's Lives Matter discussion, and we're
right.
having this discussion about black women's bodies and female athletes. And, you know, there's a reason that that we are finally talking about these things. And I think part of it, frankly, has to do with demographic shifts and the way that, you know, our country is about to become majority minority and perhaps, you know, a younger generation will lead this charge. I think it is also very encouraging that, you know, while we're still fighting for equal pay and while the Women's World Cup team obviously only made $2 million compared to the $35 million that the German team won, made for winning the Men's World Cup, you know, you do actually see equal pay in tennis finally after a very long battle that was basically spearheaded by these two very strong black women, Venus and Serena Williams. And I think that that speaks to just how much impact an individual can actually make, and given our current climate and the fact that we're having these discussions, I am actually a little bit more optimistic, perhaps, than Dave, as to whether this can actually signal a tide shift.
Just a quick question about tennis itself. I mean, many sports have this, but tennis has a long history of homophobia and racism. A long history.
Sure.
Right?
Absolutely.
So what kind of discussions do you think, how do you think this is affecting tennis now internally, that power dynamic for that federation and more?
Well, I think for years tennis has had to kind of, you know, look into itself, especially when it comes to the women's game, because, you know, there's a lot more parity in the men's game, and the men all, you know, the men kind of play by a different set of rules. But with the women, you know, you talk about our marketable stars, again, you're looking at people who might not have, you know, achieved as much on the field. And I think that tennis is really trying to grapple with this idea of, okay, you know, do we want to, you know, what kind of image do we want to sell of ourselves, and do we want to actually have, you know, the best athletes on the field, or do we want to have the, you know, the most conventionally pretty ones on the field?
And right, and defining what conventionally even means in this
right.
world. Dave, what were you about to say?
Yeah. Oh, no, just that I have a piece up that people can check out if people want to read it, about making the case about Serena Williams and Muhammad Ali and the connections that they exist and the historical parallels that they exist. And I think it's useful, if for no other reason, that it's a reminder that Muhammad Ali was not a walking saint in the 1960s, but was a polarizing figure, and that the political progenitors of bottom feeders like David Frum, people like William F. Buckley, were tried to tear down Muhammad Ali in the 1960s. So there's so much historical continuity to this. And I, frankly, that's what gives me the most hope, because I don't see the William F. Buckleys and the David Frums of this world being people who are looked upon kindly by history in terms of what they actually stood for, while Muhammad Ali is very different. And so, and I also, frankly, think it's no coincidence that Serena Williams was asked after winning Wimbledon who her hero was, and she said it was Muhammad Ali, was her athletic role model. And as she put it, she said, not just for what he did in the ring, but what for what he did outside the ring. So that's where my hope lies.
Well, a tweet just came in from RA Scientist. RA just tweeted in, Glad, at Mark Steiner Show, Glad called from out for his steroid BS. All right.
Yeah. Frum is seriously, like, just one of the worst people in media. I mean, just an awful, like, the worst element of an anonymous troll mixed in with someone who has actual power.
I mean, it would be frightening if he didn't come off so small and pathetic.
Amen to that. And I also want to thank amen to the work the two of you do. It's always great to have you all on this program here on the Mark Steiner Show. You just heard the voice of Dave Zirin, host of Edge of Sports Radio, sports editor of The Nation, authored many books, including Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. We'll be linking to the pieces he's been writing, we've been talking about on our website, as well as to Kavitha Davidson's, who is the Bloomberg View columnist. And Kavitha and Dave, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
On our way out of here, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our engineering intern is Anthony Nichols. And welcome to our new intern, Miss Manifa Wilson is with us here. Glad she's on board with us here on the Mark Steiner Show. Our intern and Dan History Research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. On our way out of here, we're hearing Pop It Don't Preach by Madonna, which hit number one on this day in 1986. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.